When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You think about the person in your life when you started believing you more than anyone else. They're the ones that made the sacrifices. When I walk out, my old man's next to me. They're not just looking at you, they're looking at what made you. Now, what I'm talking about, our fucking game. I want them talking about us. All right, enjoy your lunch.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy, and a man who did his podcast preparation on live stream. It's Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
That's me.
More on that in a moment. Very much enjoyed your podcast prep. Got a few things to say first before we properly get started. Firstly, sending love and best wishes to one of our listeners and supporters, Josh Morris, and his family. Thinking of you, mate. Hope you're doing okay. And secondly, just want to introduce a new content creator. Got this email from Marcus Wilson, who says, my 7-year-old son, Remy, has been inspired by The Extra Inch to set up his own Spurs YouTube channel exclusively for kids. It's called Chirpy Corner, at Chirpy Corner THFC, and he launched his first videos today. And he includes a link, which we'll put in our show notes. Two things occurred to me. One, that you guys should know your pod has inspired a future generation of kind-minded analytical Spurs fans. And two, that I'm sure many of your listeners will have school children. They too would love to become immersed in positive Spurs content. I know Remy would be ecstatic to hear hello from you on the pod if that were possible. So hello, Remy. Your channel is fantastic. I really liked your analysis of the game the weekend. Keep it up. It's great work. And I definitely would urge anyone with children around Remy's age to check out Chirpy Corner THFC for some excellent analysis.
Just letting you know, Remy, you start coming for our audience though, and then, you know, we're going to go to the mattresses, my friend.
I imagine Remy would write a really good AG1 ad, Bardi. He's coming for you.
It's always scary, the next generation are coming. They're coming for us. We're no longer the Clear as Seal Kids, as we used to be called, Windy. And we're getting old.
That is true. We are getting old. Oh my goodness. Two men in their 40s and Nathan, early 30s still, you can get away with saying.
We need to sell one of the oldies to a bigger podcast and bring in some young bloods to freshen the squad, I reckon.
Yeah, the two post-peak oldies.
Sell me to Saudi Arabia. I'd go there for 6 months just for the money.
Heat training. Bardi, you wanted to talk about something that came up this week as well.
Yeah, so Moby is one of our ex-subs, very active member of our kind of fitness community on Discord, also a big kind of, says lots of nice things about the Run, Push, Pull podcast, which is a Patreon bonus that I do. He's had a tough last year, and he's running the Milton Keynes Half Marathon for the Acorn Hospice, who really helped him and his partner out. If you'd like to donate to his cause, we'll put the details in for his Just Giving page in the show notes.
Good luck, Moby. Good thing to do. Well done. Jim Pollard wrote, I'm devastated to discover that Bardi is not your best friend. I was welling up as the pod revealed the heartbreaking news, not just for poor abandoned Bardi, but also for the other casualties of this callous affair. Truth, integrity, and their associated values, which I assumed clearly erroneously, The Extra Inch incarnated. I now wonder just what sort of post-truth Trumpian world the pod inhabits. It gets worse, Jim, because, I mean, I hate to be the one to tell you that Barty was laying it on thick. This is a man of many, many best friends. Barty has more best friends than I've had hot dinners. So if that helps make things a little easier, take that nugget for what it is. I also wanted to apologize for the pod last week, not because I revealed that Bardi is not my actual best friend, but I was really disappointed with how the youth segment came out. And I kind of had a bad feeling as soon as we stopped recording. And sometimes when I've had a bad feeling, I'll say to Nathan, can you just listen to how that sounded and like maybe do some editing around that section? But I thought, oh, you know what, like I'll just address it in the next pod if needs be. And quite rightly, a few people picked me up on some mistakes that I made in the discussion. But it was wider than that. Like the whole section I felt was not mine or our finest content. So specifically, I made a mistake in saying that Alfie Devine is younger than Jamie Donnelly, which is not the case. Devine is actually 5 months older than Donnelly.
Really?
So
I'm surprised by
that.
Yeah. I made the same mistake on the spot.
This is the thing. Like I know that. Because I know from the England age groups what they represented and the way they've played together. But I was just shooting from the hip, which, you know, we do as podcasters. And the reason I'm disappointed is because I normally, when I'm talking about something like this, I will have researched it and I didn't do that. I need to learn to not shoot from the hip.
Being too harsh on yourself, Wendy.
The other thing that I really messed up when I listened back was the skip timeline, which Nathan, you did pick me up on at the time. So I talked about how Skip came back from Norwich and then he should have been off to a Premier League team to get a full season. And of course, what happened was he played under Nuno alongside Højbjerg, which was a horrible midfield, by the way, and started the season. And most people thought he was doing really well. And I think we were even saying with Discord that like he'll get an England call up if he carries on playing at this level. And then he got his penis injury.
He did.
I mean, how can we forget
correct.
That?
Yes, no, of course.
And like when I listened back, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm such a hypocrite, because when he came back from Norwich, I just know that I would have been calling for him to have been involved in our first team. I just know I would. So to now say retrospectively that he should have gone on loan to a Premier League team is a very easy thing to say in hindsight, and doesn't tally with what I know I would have felt at the time. So I was disappointed about that. My wider points about loans still stand, and actually I do want to address some other youth stuff a bit later on that came up in Ange's presser this week. But yeah, just wanted to kind of correct the record on those things, and also say thank you to the people who picked me up on them. Got some very sweet messages about it. People who are saying, you know, the only reason I'm saying this basically is because I rate you guys. So appreciate that. Appreciate it a lot. Finally, we will talk about the Crystal Palace game. It's been a long intro.
We won.
The starting of, we won a game. It felt nice. It felt good. It felt good. Bardi, the starting 11 came out. Bentancur was in for Sarr, who we find out later has had some slight discomfort. Udogi was back for Davis, which was great news. And Timo Werner came in for the injured Richarlison. What did you feel about the team lineup?
Bentancur for Sarr is not too much of a problem. I think Bentancur in the Sarr role is probably his strongest position for us, which was good. Destiny back was lovely, and Richarlison not being fit is great for my wallet. So fully expecting Nathan to have to pull out some cash very soon, especially if it goes on for like a month or so.
Oh, it's good. Close.
It's going to be tight. I think it's going to be tighter than the actual title battle. The Richarlison bit. So I was reasonably happy with the starting lineup.
Yeah, I think that midfield three will eventually be our best midfield. It's certainly what I felt at the beginning of the season. Well, we all felt at the beginning of the season, right? But at the moment, Bentancur is way, way off it. He's in a tough run of form. And he's just had like a decent break between matches and not been much sharper. Wendy, you thought he was a little better.
I thought he was quite a lot better.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought he was moving a lot smoother in this game. His passing was still hit and miss, but to me, he looked much more like the old Bentancur. He was backing up the attacks well and kind of nipping in and sweeping sort of for loose balls. And he made a couple of timely interventions defensively, which I thought were useful, because that was my concern with him coming in for Sarr. You know, Sarr is really good on defensive transitions. The amount of fires he puts out before they properly start up is very helpful for the team. And I thought, will Bentancur be able to do that? But I thought he did a pretty good job of doing it. And I was really pleased that we took him off when we did, because his minutes do need to be managed.
Fair enough.
So I thought this was a step in the right direction, personally.
Okay.
Although I appreciate he's certainly not the Bentancur of, you know, where he was at his peak before injury. So I've already alluded to the fact that you did your podcast preparation on live stream, Nathan. So the Discord got to watch that for an hour on Sunday nights, and the video is now on our Patreon, patreon.com/theextrainch, if you're interested in watching Nathan's analysis of the Crystal Palace game. But do you want to kind of summarize some of the key points? Because I think it does talk to how the match went.
Yeah, so basically most Sunday nights or so at the moment, occasionally Monday afternoons, I will watch the game back and make a bunch of notes and stuff. I decided because there was a bit of mystery going into this one, because I didn't know and I was unsure why we were better in the second half, I thought it might be fun to share that with the Discord, record that, put it up as a video. And truth is, I didn't come away with a huge obvious takeaway. Here's the key point, like, oh, it was this. And I think, and we discussed this at length, and we went back and forth with the chat, and we discussed a few things were factors. Why were we better in the second half? Mainly Palace sort of came out a little more depressed in the second half. There's a period between half time and then when they scored. When was that, do you know? 60-ish?
Yeah, something like that.
So during that period of time,
57 maybe?
Yeah, 59. 57, something like that. During that period of time, they're coming out to press us a bit more. That's opening up space. As a result of that, Werner is able to receive the ball with a bit of momentum, receive the ball occasionally in behind their right wing back, Munoz, but sometimes in front of him, but with the opportunity to get a bit of space, touch out from his feet, stand Munoz up and offer to go both ways. And then we start to generate a few chances there, including what definitely should have been a penalty. I don't think there's any more discussion there, right? Bizarre that that wasn't given, that that wasn't reviewed, that the referee saying that it wasn't a foul means that it shouldn't be reviewed, whatever. And then Palace score, and then they'd go, right, well, no need to press anymore. We can sit back into our box. So there's a bit of a dead period. Johnson comes on, which also pushes Kulusevski into midfield. And I think that also at that time, there's sort of, oh shit, now we're a goal behind and there's an increased impetus and we'd start taking more risks. And eventually a couple of things pay off. Johnson wins a couple of sort of loose bounces of the ball as he goes to press. Anderson, good from him, and a lovely pass to open the scoring. And then after a set piece, Christian Romero is still up in the box. So we've got an aerial threat and a cross finds its head. And then obviously the third goal, again, Palace are in a situation they've got to come out and press. And that's where we get the third goal. Sonny in behind is always golden, right?
I had a slightly different read to you.
Okay.
I thought you highlighted this really well in the video, but didn't kind of draw it together. And I kind of wish I'd been there to comment at the time. So I think, yeah, I definitely think Palace pressed more in the second half. I think Ange gave a specific instruction at halftime for the wingers to go on the outside.
Okay.
There was so much more variety in our play in the second half. Like in the first half, Kulusevski's going to come in 9 times out of 10. Yep. That's the way he plays. But Werner was also trying to come inside or making a run inside and leaving space for Udogie to go on the outside, which he barely did. In the first attack of the second half, Emerson Royale attempted to go on the outside and failed. The second attack of the second half, Werner got around the outside, put a brilliant cross in. If Johnson's on the pitch, he taps it into the back post, but Kulusevski can't get there because he's not quick enough. And then there were then several Kulusevski cutting inside and losing the ball moments. But then Werner went on the outside, and like you say, he should have won a penalty. Kulusevski went on the outside and cut back for Son, who shot against the post. At that point, it's only 54 minutes in, and we've done it 4 times already. 60 minutes, Maddison went on the outside and got a cross in. 61 minutes, Kulusevski does the same move again, going on the outside and cutting back to Son. But this time, he didn't shoot first time. He kind of took a touch, tried to pass to Werner. And then when Johnson came on, he attempted to receive the ball on the outside in his first burst forward, but Bissouma played a poor pass straight out for a throw-in. Werner went again on the outside, passed into the box to Maddison. Johnson went out on the outside again and won a corner. Werner tried to go on the outside again, but got doubled up on and had to check back. So by this point, Palace are realising what's happening and they're trying to stop it. He goes on the outside again and gets a cutback, which is cleared. We then score. And even then, after the goal, Emerson Royale goes on the outside again. So I think there was a quite obvious change from Spurs, which worked really well in this game because Palace weren't defending narrow. And I think if they had been defending really narrow and just protecting their box, we wouldn't have been able to play this way. I think we'd have had to have been a bit more inventive. But frankly, this was what I wanted at halftime. I wanted Spurs to go on the outside more and try and force set pieces because I thought we might need set pieces to break the stubborn defence down. As it turned out, we didn't need the set pieces. We could just rely on getting on the outside and putting crosses in. And I think it worked really effectively.
You lay out a pretty strong case there. I guess the only thing is, like, if that was the case, why isn't that, like, ever the default? Why isn't that how we start matches? Surely there's enough knowledge within the coaching team and the players as well that you know, you've got to offer or you've got to threaten outside sometimes as well. This is just a reminder at halftime.
A reminder, but also I think it's down to personnel partly.
Okay.
With Son and Kulusevski in the same team, two players who want to cut inside and get shots away, it's not natural to them to try and beat their men on the outside. With Werner in the team, he's probably the best we have in the squad of forcing his man down the outside. And Werner is also really prepared to put in a cross with his weak foot, which I really appreciate from him. It keeps defenders guessing. I like it a lot.
Yeah.
Johnson's not too bad at it. Like, Johnson will attempt it, but even still with Johnson, he sometimes wants to kind of drive towards the goal in a very direct fashion or get on the end of a pass rather than carry the ball on the outside. So I think it's personnel. I think... I've been quite critical of Son in the wide areas recently. I think could be put down to fatigue, emotional, mental fatigue, physical fatigue. But I do think he has struggled a bit on the left in Ange ball.
I agree.
And moving him away from the left, I think, helped us. And having Werner back in the team helped us.
I agree with that. I think that I will now reach the hot take of we can't have Son and Richarlison on the pitch at the same time.
I think you might be right. I think it's one or the other. And I think they should both be used a lot in the striker role.
Yeah, mix it up. If the team, yeah.
That's a good hot take, but I've got a hot take which I've been saving. I think we can no longer play with Kulusevski as a wide man. I think in games like this, I think the constant need for him to come inside is causing us problems. It's congesting everything. As soon as first of all, Palace have no counter-attacking threat. As soon as Eze was off the pitch, that's it. Palace have finished as an entity. Now it's all about Tottenham. So I think what Ange did, which was pretty smart, was putting Johnson on. And like you said with Werner was offering us something down the left, and Johnson came on and changed the game for us down the right. Johnson is not the perfect winger, but I think he's a better winger than Kulusevski. And that might upset people, but I just don't think Kulusevski works right now in that role, especially against a low block. I don't think he offers us enough speed. Like you said, he's not arriving at the back post like Johnson does, and he doesn't have those moments like Johnson does. So I think Werner and Johnson, either side of Sonny, is probably, for me, I think, a more efficient front three. And I think Kulusevski as an alternate to Bentancur in the middle, or an alternate to Maddison, is probably where he should be playing right now. It's not to say he's a bad player. I'm just talking about balance.
No, I think I agree with you. I think Kulusevski on the wing has been a source of frustration for me most of the season. His defensive work there is outstanding, and some of his transition stuff is good, but he can't get around his man. I've been getting this question a lot. It's probably not in the running order, right? But I get asked, like, what if we played Kulusevski on the left? Then he could go outside, right? But I think that he would be much worse on the left. I think that because he's so unexplosive, because he doesn't have a sprint from a start, the only time he gets around his man is when he uses the threat of inside to go outside, right? When he's able to use guile. And if he's on the left, no one's going to believe he's going to cut inside, and no one's worried about him possibly cutting inside. So he can only go outside, which means it's just a straight foot race between him and his man. He's always going to lose his foot race. So I think on the left, he would be worse. And we saw him on the left for about 5 minutes. He didn't even receive the ball. And I think that receiving the ball would be difficult for him on the left even.
Oh, so perhaps it wasn't as spicy take as I thought.
I think this is a really good position for us to get to where we're talking about a player as good as Dejan Kulusevski not necessarily being the best for the role, and also the fact that he's so versatile and can play quite effectively, in my opinion, in midfield is useful, because next season we're going to need to see a lot of rotation. I'm still quite comfortable with him on the right. I don't think he's the worst winger in the world in Ange Ball. I think he's fine. But I agree that Johnson probably should be starting at the moment on the right. But the idea of him rotating in for Bentancur or Maddison or Johnson is fine. I'm pretty happy with that.
I guess one other counter argument would be that Johnson wins this game because he comes on as fresh legs and has that advantage, and therefore he arrives first to a couple of loose balls. He's able to press hard and be tenacious because he's fresh coming into the game. And if Kulusevski, you know, gives them one threat to worry about for 60 minutes, and then Johnson poses a different threat, then we're able to mix it up there. So that could be a way to carry on as we currently are going. But yeah, I feel like for me, under Conte, obviously, especially in Conte's first season, Kulusevski was like our brightest spark. I absolutely adored him on the right, inside right. But he had space to operate in those situations, you know. And that just isn't materializing a lot of the time. He's always going to be an option on the right when it's a bit more of an open game. But at the moment where it's not, he's just sort of isolated out there, basically.
Mm-hmm. And I think especially with Son as the number nine, he doesn't help Son by cutting back inside and crossing. Son is he's not Richarlison. He's not going to win a header. He's not going to flick a header on. So it just doesn't suit. So I think it's almost like if you're playing Son, you got to build a front three around Son and play to his strengths. And I just don't think Kulusevski and Son work in the same way. I don't think Richarlison and Son work at the same time on the pitch. It's not a criticism of any of them. It's just a balance, isn't it, really?
So speaking of Son, TJ Thompson said, rewatching the Palace match, it was obvious how much more effective the overall system was when Werner was willing to drive to the byline. Why have we not seen Son utilised on the right side? Ange is willing to play him as a winger, and he would be comfortable on his stronger foot to get round the low block, but Son has demonstrated an ability to take long shots on his left. What are your thoughts? Nathan, could Son feasibly play as a right-sided winger in Ange Ball?
He played on the right a handful of times under Pochettino. More than a handful, actually. But that was never his best side. It's kind of odd. And I remember making this point before, right? Can you name a player more two-footed than Son? You struggle to, right?
Perisic, maybe, and... maybe Perisic. Andreas Bremer, if I'm going back like 30 years.
I think the most two-footed player I've seen at Spurs might be Carrick. Son's ball striking is really good off both feet, but he dribbles predominantly on his right.
That's the thing, isn't it, right? He's in terms of striking the ball, he's outrageously two-footed, but he's still actually quite one-sided despite that because of the angles he creates with his body when he's dribbling. So I wouldn't mind seeing it. I think that, you know, while Kulusevski and Johnson are providing their own limitations, whilst Son and Richarlison aren't great at sharing the pitch together for a variety of tactical reasons, I wouldn't mind having a look at like a Richarlison central, Werner left, Son right combination in a game, get a glance of that. I think obviously the biggest downside is it turns Son into a pure creator. He's going to struggle to get shooting opportunities from the right, and that's not optimal use of the best finisher the game has ever seen, right? But maybe it's the best combination of players that we have. So I wouldn't mind having a look at that just to see if he can get around his man to the right-hand side.
On that point about his finishing, I mean, there was a really useful direct comparison there between Son and Werner running through on goal. When Werner ran through, not a single part of me thought he was scoring. And when Son ran through, I knew it was a goal as soon as he got the ball.
Yep. I think that's the kind of issue at the moment with Werner. It's good that he scored his goal. It was a nice... tapped it in, which is good, but I just think he needs to just almost like concentrate on his instinctiveness. It's painful watching him go through in a one-on-one. Just keep your head down, mate. Get to the byline and whip it in.
Yeah,
I did think he was really impressive though, Werner. For me, he was man of the match.
Probably.
I really, really liked his performance, and I think we are better with him in the team at the moment.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And that might be because he's the player that is the dribbliest of our wingers, Nathan. So you'd hope that there would be an upgrade in the dribbly winger area come the summer. But I think we do have to keep an eye on Werner's performances. And if he plays at that level for the rest of the season, then there's no reason why we won't sign him.
Yeah, I intended to come into this podcast without saying it right, but you've forced my hands. Look at how threatening we are when a career striker is doing an okay impression of a dribbly winger. And think about if we had a real first 11 quality specialist in that role. Okay,
like
we can
who?
Move on now,
like,
under 30
like who?
Seconds.
Who
like
who
Nico Williams.
There it is. Fiddle was playing the drinking game. Get the shots in.
So Ivan Victor says, what did you think about Ange twice making subs after we scored the 2-1 and 3-1? To me, it was a great way of taking some emotion out of the game and not giving Palace the chance to storm back. I really liked his use of subs in this game, but I'm interested in getting your guys' thoughts.
I generally liked them. There was a 5 to 10 minute period where we had Højbjerg, Saar, and who would have been?
Kulusevski.
Maybe Kulusevski midfield combination. No, I think it was, give me 1 second because I tweeted it. Oh, a Basuma, Højbjerg, Saar midfield for a 5 to 10 minute period, which wasn't exciting.
Did.
But never mind, right? Because we brought on Lo Celso a little while after that. I think that, like, good use of the squad in this game, but also, more importantly, good, very good general management to bring us to a point in the season where we have a squad. Yeah. And this isn't just me digging at Conte and Mourinho, because this goes back to Pochettino as well. This applies somewhat to Nuno, even Mason, right? For a long time, we've had a run of coaches who have exactly 15 players, right?
Yeah.
And if you're not in the top 15, you're dead. You don't exist. And I think that, like, you know, we'll take Johnson. Take Johnson in this game, right? Johnson, really good sort of expected goals per 90 this season, but decisive in this game. 2 assists, in my opinion. But a frustrating player, a player who's caused frustration for me, for other fans, a divisive player as well as a decisive player. I think that he would have, like, put a couple of bad performances in under all of those previous coaches and then become like a non-factor in the squad, right? And Johnson can have a bad performance for us because that's the type of player he is, and then still be a useful player off the bench in the next match, right? And that's down to Postecoglou's handling of the squad, respect for players, belief in the different profiles and varieties within a thinner amount of profiles, and benefits of fresh legs. We really have a squad again now. And that makes me feel so much better about our recruitment going forward, because we bring in a first 11 quality player. We bring in 2 first 11 quality players. That makes our squad so much deeper, because you're taking players out the first 11. We just talked about Kulusevski. What a player Kulusevski is to not be a first 11 player, to have a player like that on the bench, to come in, whether it's midfield or it's on the wing or even something else, to change shape, to have those kind of options. I think that I talked about all of the reasons we didn't play better in the second half. A significant amount of it is just having squad depth and fresh legs and the ability to make slight variations in how we're doing things.
Jonathan says, is one of the reasons we look so good right after halftime in a lot of matches that's when teams decide to press us? That was certainly the case with Palace, but any ideas on why that is so?
Well, it's very hard to unlock a low block, and we're actually low-key incredibly good at playing out from the back. We might be one of the best teams in the world at playing out from the back, like one of the 5 best teams in the world at playing out from the back. I don't know, like, this is Glasner's first game at Palace, and he wants to, like we kind of talked about a lot recently with Ange, he wants to instill a methodology into his team, right? And we will remember his Frankfurt, that they were a pressing side. He wants to coach his side to press. Also, in my opinion, if you've watched a bunch of Spurs games as part of your match preparation, if you watched the Brentford game and went, oh, they held Spurs off really frustratingly in a low block for 45 minutes. They came out in the second half and pressed for 10 minutes and they went 3 goals down. And then you also watch the Wolves match and you go, oh, Wolves stayed in their low block for 97 minutes and it won them the game. I don't know about the decision to come out and press in the second half, man. I think that's a pretty risky call. I mean, he got them a goal, essentially, right? Not direct from the press, but still.
Yeah, I mean, the goal was a pure counter-attack. That was just Eze doing Eze things. I just think I was very unimpressed by Glasner. Yes, he tried to mimic what Wolves did, but I was very unimpressed with him. I was expecting something a bit different, something a bit braver. He just basically did a Ten Hag and just sat there waiting to lose. And eventually we were able to capitalize on moments and we got good forwards. And so yeah, that was a shot at Ten Hag. It was an absolute cabbage of a manager.
Bardi, I wanted to ask you about the free kick that we conceded. Obviously, a really good strike from Eze. I think it was the right decision from Bentancur to give the free kick away in the first place, even in hindsight. But what did you think of the way that Vicario set the wall up?
It never looks good when it's the goalkeeper's side. So, yeah, it never looks good. He should have saved it. It wasn't top corner. It was low. But he saved us enough this season that I'm not going to go in on him there. It's always difficult, you know.
So he gets the benefit of the doubt.
He gets the benefit of the doubt. It was pretty central, but a central free kick is kind of hard to manage, but I would like him to have saved it. But he gets a pass.
Any blame for the way we set up our wall in general, everyone except for Vicario? Any thoughts on our wall and so on?
I mean, perhaps it could have been a bit... But you want the wall to kind of stop the striker from attempting to go over. So the easy way to score is you get it over the wall and in, but it's very difficult to do that, which is why it doesn't happen very often. So you're almost kind of tempting them to try that and you're protecting the other side. If he goes over the wall, it's a fantastic goal. There's nothing you could do. So perhaps he should have set his wall a little bit further right just to give himself a better view of the free kick if it came straight to him. So there's perhaps that, but I don't know. We'd have to look at how he's been setting his walls up in the past. Is this the first free kick we conceded this season? Maybe. I don't know. But
but I can't remember.
Either way, if it goes your side, you'd expect a goalkeeper to save it unless it's a Gazza in the top corner.
Yeah, I think I agree with setting the wall slightly further to the right in hindsight, but definitely something to keep an eye on in the future. Cole says, was talking to my brother post-game and he said, we're so good at blitzing teams into oblivion. When teams panic against us, we're deadly, which made me think there's been a good few games this season where we've scored goals in quick succession due to us capitalising on teams' breakdown in shape immediately after conceding. What needs to happen for us to induce those moments of panic earlier on in games instead of waiting until the 70th minute to start scoring on our goals? Bardi, this is definitely a theme, a pattern that has been emerging recently.
Well, it's harder to keep concentration once you're tired, and it's even harder to reset once you've conceded the goal. So we've already spoken about Ange making substitutions after a goal to slow things down. Perhaps that's what Glasner should have done. But we've got such good players, man, that if you give them opportunities, if you break out of that kind of low block and you give us space, we're going to hurt you. So it's great that we score goals in patterns. And it's what good teams do. They take those moments and then they punish you.
Dribbly winger helps cause chaos. And I pointed out a moment in the live stream where it got to a point where Werner was going outside repeatedly, that he started to draw two players towards him and that opened up space in the middle, something that we've talked about before. But Harry Brooks did a thread at halftime from the stadium, huge tech skills to do a series of short GIFs on the timeline in threaded form, analysis at halftime, not queuing for the lose at halftime. Incredible skills from him. A thread on like areas where we could have been more aggressive in possession in the first half, how we were quite passive despite having all of the ball, not taking risks in possession. And I think that I think back to when we were at our best under Pochettino, we were less well structured in our possession. We had fewer ideas and patterns to our play, but we could take risks. We took risks again and again and again and again because we knew if we lost the ball, we just win it back again. Whereas maybe right now that Wolves game is in our head a little bit. Taking risks, losing the ball, getting countered, and it's all a bit spooky. I do wonder if that was in our heads a little bit in the first half, the Wolves game, perhaps.
So Aston Villa and Tottenham are two of the founding teams of the Premier League, and we've shared an intertwined history. But just how incestuous is our relationship? How many players can you name that have played for us and them in the Premier League era?
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Windy versus Nathan. The clash starts now. Windy, you can go first.
Darren Bent.
Darren Bent, correct. One for Windy. Nathan.
Oh God. I'm blanking. Oh, help me.
We go back to Windy. No. Windy, back to you. Can you take advantage?
This should be so straightforward.
I know there's loads.
Am I right in thinking that Øyvind Leonardsson played for Villa?
Leonardsson, very good. That's two. Nathan, can you come back?
I'm not doing very well. Oh my God, I'm really blanking.
Back to you, Windy.
Clément Longley.
Clément Longley is another one. It's actually Nathan, you got any?
I'm panicking now. You're panicking. I'm Timo Werner through on goal.
You're good at this stuff, Nathan, normally.
Yeah, normally. My head's gone. I'm done.
Windy, can you give us a couple more? Let's see if you can get 5 from 5 penalties.
In my head, they seem so clear, but I'm not 100% sure. Neil Sullivan?
No. Another goalkeeper, though. A couple of goalkeepers.
Oh, Brad Friedel. Yeah, that's
Brad
easy.
Friedel.
Who would the other goalkeeper be?
Josh Onuma.
Josh Onuma. Well, there we go.
Josh Onuma. Come on, Windy. That should be yours.
How did I not get that one?
Josh Onuma. Go on.
Literally, Josh Onuma's biggest fan.
Okay. Nathan's on caused chaos. Now. He's caused chaos in the low block. Come on, hit him.
Oh, crap. Did Lennon have a spell at Villa?
No.
He was at Burnley.
No, Burnley. Claret and Blue, eh? There's another keeper.
There was another keeper. This is. I'll give you 5 points if you get that goalkeeper, though.
Oh, okay, I'm not going to get him. Fine. No, never mind.
One more guess, Windy, before I reveal who else you could have got.
I'm sure I'm missing some really obvious ones.
Big ones.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Okay. You could have had Alan Hunt. You could have had Gallini. You could have had Tom Carroll.
Gallini.
Robbie Keane.
Tom Carroll's a Villa.
Yeah.
Keane, yeah.
Luke Young. Jermaine Genus. Carl Walker. Wayne Routledge. Peter Crouch, David Ginola, and Colin Calderwood.
Oh, my God.
Were all options.
God.
My days.
Oh, I'm disappointed. Walker, Keane, and Ginola, I'm disappointed that I didn't get those.
Gallini totally took me by surprise. If I've missed any...
Gallini?
When they're in the championship.
Championship.
He was there, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
What's the one thing Spurs have taught us, Windy?
Patience.
As usual, you're half right, but that's not what I'm looking for. I'm talking about keeping going, staying focused, and energy. Spurs' ability to keep going is one of the remarkable things we've seen at home this season. As a regular user of AG1, I've definitely seen an uptake in my energy levels, and this remains the case despite being 7 weeks into a training plan. I may not be moving like Timo or bursting with speed like Brennan, but I can keep the balance of my work life, exercise routine, and hot takes going by keeping AG1 in my routine. But it's not just about energy. As Maranoia, the paranoia you get before a marathon starts to set in, I get peace of mind that AG1 is helping me with my full spectrum of vitamins and minerals that support my immune system that I can miss out in my diet. So feeling more energetic, get AG1 in you, get that peace of mind that you're getting a comprehensive nutritional support for your lifestyle. Get AG1 in you, mate.
If there's one product we had to recommend to elevate your health, it's AG1, and that's why we partnered with them for so long. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase exclusively at drinkag1.com/extrainch. That's drinkag1.com/extrainch. Check it out. So just to finish off the post-Palace analysis, Kay says, do you think our nascent approach against low blocks, start slow, finish fast, is something that could last long-term? What do you think, Nathan? Sort of wear them out a bit in the first half with some moving side to side and then bring on some punchy players to get the job done?
Yeah, probably for the rest of the season, I guess. And Ange kind of spoke to this post-match. He talked positively of the first half. He said, look, we were tiring them out. We were keeping the pressure on them. We were giving them things to think about, which is certainly not how I was experiencing the first half myself, so I'm not going to criticize other fans for feeling that way either, right? So interesting to see if he, because again, we framed this all as like there was the first half and then things changed in the second half, but maybe Ange sees it as very much a whole. You don't get the second half without the pressure building up on them in the first half, perhaps. But yeah, minor tweaks at halftime are probably going to continue to be significant.
It's interesting, isn't it? The Discord was losing its shit at halftime. People were fuming. It was like, people do get a bit excited sometimes in the live thread, but it was particularly bad in this game. And I thought it was sort of fine. I just sort of said, this is hard. They're playing low block and it's really hard to break down. Like, remember Nathan's last video? Just watch that again. That explains this game broadly. And then when Palace scored, it was horrendous. And I put, don't worry, we'll still win. And there were, I got 9 sob reacts to my message. So I understand, like you, why people were so angry. But I do think it's a pattern, isn't it? Like, this is a thing that's happened a few times. So we do have to watch out for it. Like, keep the ball, be sensible, move from side to side. Eventually, mentally, they'll become fatigued and we'll kick in. And Partner Fartner says, it seems as if a Madaskulu double 8-10 with speed outside is rightfully going to be our mid-game answer to low blocks going forward. The question is, why are we waiting until the 70th minute to do so? What is it about Kulusevski and Madders and Johnson and our squad makeup that make this work as a mid-game personnel tweak? And what is it about those three or the squad that makes Ange hesitant to implement this from the opening whistle? Bardi, why is it that he left it so late to bring Johnson on?
I have no idea. I don't know.
I guess the later Johnson comes on, the more sort of physical advantage he has. Yeah, and this is something he talked about earlier, that he had fresh legs. He arrived first to a loose ball on a couple of times, and that scored the opening goal for us, right? So he's maybe not going to do that if he comes on at halftime, perhaps, but he maybe will do that if he comes on around 60 minutes, you could argue. I guess the other thing is, like, if you bring that, if you're like, oh, well, they're only Palace, they're probably going to low block again like that other team did before. Let's start with Kulusevski in midfield. What if they don't, right? What if instead they're going to play like a physical mid-block game and suddenly you've got the wrong 11 for that? So I think you have to wait until the opposition have shown their hand and you've seen what the patterns of the game are before, because like we go into every game with a very attacking mentality, with a very attacking combination of players. So then be like, we should start with 2 number 10s. And just like 3 players behind the ball ever. That, like, it's you're asking for like a lot. Like, Ange is about as attacking as it gets and you're asking for more, you know? I don't mind us not making that change until later in the game.
What I quite like about this is I think long term this result is going to have really good, like, an impact, because a team came to low block and we smacked them up. And I think that's important, that it doesn't become a trend, that we keep beating these teams at low block and we keep going and keep doing that. So people have to mix it up, so it won't be a case of, okay, this is how you stop them, let's just do it like this. In the kind of same way that teams now have to be a bit smarter when they play Man City, because they know they just can't sit back and wait for them to, and hope they don't do something. So this is really good that we beat Palace, like, long term.
That's a really good point, and I think brings us nicely to Villa, who I suspect will play quite a lot of low block counter. And unlike Palace, Villa have a genuine, exceptional counter-attacking threat in Watkins, Bailey, Diaby, whoever ends up playing on the left. There's some good players there to cause us real bother, Nathan.
Yeah, Villa are an interesting period. What's their run of form been like, actually? I'm curious. Give me a
second. It's been outrageously good in terms of the results, but Yeah, I watched their game against Luton at the weekend, and they were really lucky to beat Luton. To be honest, I felt like Luton deserved to win the game. On expected goals, they were the better team, but it wasn't just expected goals. You know, they, in certainly the second half, Luton completely dominated and Villa retreated into their shell, and they just kind of scored at a good moment. Alfie Doughty, outstanding again, by the way. Definitely someone we should be looking at for our fullback roles, I believe.
Aston Villa, they've had some soft games and they've punished some bad teams. But on the whole, they've been kind of fortunate that they've got some big guns up front that can grab some goals. I don't think their run can continue. The Europa League kicks in really for them as well this week, I think. So I think we're playing them at a good time, and I do have some faith, especially if they're going to like do that high line. I don't know if that's still a thing. If Villa are still doing the high line, they are. So. I do think they have a profile that suits our style of play.
So, we sort of know how Villa play out of possession, right? They play the mid block with a high defensive line. They don't pressure the first line of possession very much. And at the moment, they're playing Tielemans as their like number 10 / second forward. And he has like no, like he was always like a low intensity, low work rate player. And now he's old as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's time on the ball for Romero to pick out a pass, in my opinion. But obviously they are very, very good at playing their offside line. I think the plan coming into the season for them was to play a back three. They brought in Pau Torres and it looked like they wanted to play a back three. But Mings is out for the whole season injured. So they're playing like a 4-4-2 out of possession. And then they move into a 3-4-3 with Moreno pushing up on one side and maybe Cash tucking in. Is that right? Mm-hmm. And then the width is coming. Ramsey or McGinn plays left wing, but tucks into to make a midfield three. So it's like a 3-5-2 essentially, or a 3-2-2-3. Is that a thing? Something like that. Anyway, the point I'm trying to get to is Moreno pushes up very high, and so there's space behind him. When Villa have the ball, there's space behind the wide areas generally, and I think that we can get them on transition. Will cause them serious problems. I think they probably have a transition defense issue at the moment, but obviously the theme of the last few matches now is the opposition never wanting to have the ball and it always being attack versus defense. So yeah, I don't know. That's kind of tricky because obviously we'd like to be able to set up a situation where we can play the ball over the top to Werner or Johnson or Son running in behind. And that's always the case with Villa, but it's always easier said than done, right? Because Villa find ways to trap the offside. We definitely lack passes from deep. I don't know if Porro might be available for this game. That would be significant if he is, because Porro can pass from those situations to find the ball over the top. But I wonder if what we should be preparing in this game is combinations that allow Romero to step forward and receive like a 1-2. So Romero passes it into Bissouma. Bissouma lays it off to the side. Romero runs behind Tielemans, and that's where he can pick up the diagonal pass. I'd be looking to run that drill quite a few times in training over the next week and look to get that combination going for the match. Additionally, Villa from set pieces have been interesting this season. Obviously, when we played them last, they scored 2 set piece goals against us. I remember Pau Torres didn't have to jump to head his one in. Because he can't jump. The interesting thing with their set pieces is that like they're kind of, I guess they're a little bit like us. They're glass cannons. And what I mean by that is that they scored a lot of goals from set pieces, but they've also conceded a lot of goals from set pieces. So set pieces could end up being sort of the story of the game.
Who's their set piece taker? Is it Douglas Luiz?
Sure. Probably maybe Tielemans, looking at their squads.
I do feel though that the gap of 5 points, it does feel, I hate to say it, I hate to use the sky words, but it does feel like a must win for Tottenham. I think if the gap,
this is going to be significant.
This will be definitely significant. If we can't let it get to 8 points, it would need a disaster. I'm just hoping Ajax can do us a favour on Thursday and really kind of run Villa ragged.
Yeah, is it a Thursday Sunday for them?
Thursday again for them.
Oh,
and
oh,
the
that's
first leg
the
is away.
Turn leg, so they're going away. Okay, Yeah, that, I mean, that should be something for us to take advantage of. And maybe, again, it will be a matter of late subs when they're tired late on in the game. Mm. You know, saving Johnson for 60 minutes, that kind of thing. Richarlison said something vaguely promising. He said, I'm already training on Monday, so today. I already have training on the field, so he's been running. And I believe that next Saturday, the game's on Sunday, mate. he says he'll be ready. So I think that he's like maybe a 50-50 for whether we're going to have Richarlison as well, which will be interesting because, again, I think that we've got a pick between Son and Richarlison at the moment. Maybe start with Son, and then Richarlison is an option to come off the bench if we are pushing them back and we need a target in the box, and that gives Richarlison more recovery time.
Yeah, I did quite enjoy Richarlison wearing the old pony top on Saturday.
He looks good in that.
He's very smart in his ability just to keep the fans happy. And I think that's probably why every club he's been to, the fans are really, they say a lot of nice things about him, because he's really smart in keeping the fans on side and keeping everyone really supportive. But I know he did look good. He looked like a model.
I'd be a bit smart, but like, I don't think he's like putting it on. I think he's being very genuine, and that's what people like about him, his authenticity. Yeah. He wears his heart on his sleeve very much, doesn't he?
Yeah, perhaps smart.
Apparently he's so popular amongst younger Spurs fans. Awesome. And I really get that.
Well, the celebration lends himself to that as well.
Absolutely. Nathan, on that point about Romero stepping forward,
yeah,
I just wanted to share with you something that I noticed in the under-21s. So we've been playing George Abbott, who is a bit of a utility player, but primarily a defensive midfielder at centre-back, with Tyrell Ashcroft, who is primarily a right-back but can play centre-back at right-back. And they've been playing Ange Ball, so I think that is the first thing to note. But rather than the right back becoming a midfielder, George Abbott steps out of defence and becomes a midfielder, and Tyrell Ashcroft slides along from right back to centre back in possession. So have the same build-up shape, the 2-3 build-up shape, but it's formed in a slightly different way. And I wondered whether we might see that with the first team for the Crystal Palace game, with Romero stepping up to become the midfielder and Emerson Royale sliding across to become the centre-back in build-up. But obviously, we didn't do that. It didn't turn out that way. But I thought it was really interesting. And given that we're playing the same system now from the first team to the academy teams, I assume it's something that has come up in discussion amongst all the coaching staff, and perhaps is something we could look out for in the future. Worth thinking about. Before we go, I mentioned earlier that I wanted to say something about the youth players again, and it's based on a comment that Ange made in his press conference, and I've read an awful lot into this. So the caveat is this might have been a throwaway comment that meant very little from Ange, so I'm not going to damn him forever. But he said about the possibility of Dane Scarlett. Let me state the question that was asked. Does the Richarlison injury open the door for Dane Scarlett to get an opportunity, is what he was asked by one of the journalists at the press conference. And Ange said, yeah, but the door is never closed. He trains with us every day and all the players are in the same boat. That door is always open. If you're waiting for some secret magic door to open, it doesn't exist. The door is always open and they have an opportunity every day to put themselves in front of me and the coaches to make an impact and wait for the opportunity. And my response to that is there should be a magic door. There should be a specific magic door for youth players, because otherwise they don't get opportunities unless, one, they somehow miraculously become better than the alternative player. So Dane Scarlett becomes a better finisher than world's best finisher, Son Heung-min. Or they have to wait for an almighty injury crisis. And even then, in the case of Spurs this season, young players still don't get a chance. So I believe there needs to be a magic door for young players. I'm not saying that Dane Scarlett should be starting right now, by the way, but I think there should be opportunities for players to come on and take minutes. And I was really pleased that Scarlett did come on in this game. I thought it was a good thing. And Donnelly getting a few minutes recently and Scarlett getting a few minutes here, I think is a good sign and hopefully a sign of things to come. in the future under Ange.
Would have been useful in this game to have had Veliz, though, in my opinion. And in the end, it was Romero up from a corner to offer that aerial threat. But we messed about with... We played Scarlet in like a cup game or something, so we can't go out on another loan. Is that correct?
I believe so.
So we had to loan, or we didn't have to, but we chose to loan Veliz instead to keep Scarlet as the third striker, which, yeah, he doesn't offer different to what Sonny offers.
Absolutely. Yeah, really good point. So the reason that this interested me so much is because Liverpool played a whole bunch of academy players over the course of the last two, three, four matches because partly they have an injury crisis. But as I said before, they have been quite brave in their use of young players. They've played players when they haven't had to play them. And if we look at their front six... from their under-21 match against Stoke of 11th of February, all of them have played for Liverpool's first team in the last week, which is really quite something. And that Liverpool under-21 side is, or was at the time that I researched it, 8 points behind our under-21 side in the PL2. And if you go through player by player and look at sort of the representation they're getting at England levels, or international level, I should say, because Louis Kumas is Welsh, they're not players that are better than ours. They're not players that are getting representation at international level more than ours. We have players who are as good, if not better, than these Liverpool players. So if Klopp can do it, then there's no reason that Postecoglou can't, and hopefully in the future that is something we'll see. Partly because I think there's nothing better than seeing an academy player in the first team for Spurs, especially when they do as well as Harry Kane has done. But also, I think when you have an academy that's producing players as talented as ours, it is a vital revenue stream, which can then lead to you signing better first team quality players as well. So it's a no-brainer, and it's a no-lose for me to introduce some academy players a little bit and give them some experience, and then either decide to sell them on for profit or to hopefully bolster your squad with them, which Liverpool have done in the last few weeks. Okay, I was going to end the pod there, but I feel like this is a good one to finish on. This is from Mark Bird, who said, I wanted to get your thoughts on whether, given the current financial situation with clubs struggling to meet FFP rules, Levy's previous financial prudence is now beginning to pay off. He's clearly made mistakes, certainly with managerial appointments and also with player recruitment in the past, along with things such as ticket prices in the Super League. However, all those times when people were saying just pay the money or pay them what they want, and Levy saved a few million here and there, seems to have been with a long-term plan in mind. Levy has been mocked for trying to increase our revenue too, and has been accused of putting things like Beyonce concerts and the F1 track ahead of the football. Gets this massively increased revenue and tight control of the finances, which appears to have put us in a very strong position at the moment. For example, if we can pry Gallagher away from Chelsea and then contrast with them and some of the other big spenders, For example, if we can pry Gallagher away from Chelsea, then the contrast with them and some of the other big spenders will be stark. Chelsea, who threw money around, are potentially having to sell their captain and one of their better performers this season, and we could be there to take advantage. On top of that, we finally appear to be getting business done quickly and efficiently, with players heading in and out, all with plenty of time to spare in the window. Do you think this improvement is here to stay and sustainable in the long term, or am I giving Levy too much credit? Bardi, purple and gold still, for life?
For life. It's all the only colours I wear. I think it's quite easy to... The problem with Daniel Levy is when things are going well, he gets a pass. And then when things are going bad, everybody comes back out and they're hanging around the club shop again, which they're not at the moment. There's no one there because we're doing all right. So that's always the thing. Football, you're only as good as your results. And as long as Spurs keep winning and there's a nice buzz around the club and Postecoglou keeps saying nice things, then the protests are gonna disappear. He has done the right things by increasing our revenue, and it hasn't put us in the financial problems that we've had. In the January transfer window, I think only Palace actually spent more than us. I'm not sure what the loan fee was for Werner, but we were one of the top spenders in European football in January. So that's definitely a good thing coming from Levy. But is his financial prudence now paying off? No, because he's messed up so many times. I don't think this has been a master plan of Levy to end up with Ange Postecoglou. We know for sure that Postecoglou is not his kind of manager. It's only because he's failed with the elite managers, so-called elite managers, that we've gone to Postecoglou.
Yeah, I want to dig into this question a little bit. I think the opening question and the general argument, absolutely, everything's coming up Daniel right now. Yeah, We've got the largest room for spending under the, was it called in the PRS or something, PSR, something like that, the Premier League's version of FFP, which is the one that seems to have some actual teeth right now that is causing problems for other clubs. But then there's also a point about times where we've been like, just pay the money. We as fans have been, just pay them what they want. And that's where I disagree. I don't think that's hugely relevant. Times where Levy's reluctance to do 10% higher than his last offer, you know, to close that gap, to compromise, those aren't what's made the difference here, right? The things that made the difference are what you later move on to in the question, talking about the F1 track, talking about Beyonce concerts, the focus of the stadium as like a year-round business, not something that's just open for like 30 weekends a year, right? But something that's generating revenue all the time in all these different ways. And then similarly to that point, I would say like, definitely Levy gets praise for all of that acumen, gets criticism for times that he's been a bit too stringent. And similarly, I would use that same kind of figure, 10%. Like, do we really need to be extracting on a per ticket basis the amount of money we're taking out of fans? It's tough for me to get to games, man. My dad had to give me off a season ticket. We're earning so well, we don't need to keep putting those ticket prices up again and again and again. We're all earning less well against inflation, and the ticket prices are going up above inflation. That's where my biggest criticism of Levy is. Previously, my biggest criticism has been like how he's run the club. We talked about Conte and Mourinho and the other mistakes over the last few five or so years. It looks like he's taken a significant step back from his football operations, right? He's put Scott Munn in between him and the director of football. We have a director of football, so there's all that gap now between Daniel Levy and the football decision-making, which is exactly what we asked for, exactly what we've needed for several years. But yeah, we could be squeezing, he could be squeezing less out of us, quite frankly. We can afford a bit more room there. And
thing about Levy, Levy's always two steps away from messing it up again. Because I don't know if you remember when we went up to Manchester, we did the overlap. For a part of the production, I was sat next to Robbie, and it was when the £100 million news of the £100 million war chest dropped. I don't know if you remember this. So we just finished fourth. Arsenal in bits. Everybody's in a good mood, and all of a sudden we have this £100 million war chest. We're going to go out, do this, do that, and then we end up dropping a load of money on club signings and buying Longley, upsetting a really easily upsettable manager, and things turn to shit. And that's Daniel Levy doing that. So hopefully he's learned from that, and hopefully he will keep strengthening us from a position of power, because he can be seconds away from doing something stupid.
So the profit and sustainability rules that Nathan referenced earlier, they allow you to make a loss of 105 million over three years, a rolling 3 years, I assume. And yes, Spurs now have the greatest leeway in the league to make a whole bunch of signings. So that 100 million war chest probably falls into insignificance compared to what we could spend according to the rules. But we won't spend all that, obviously, because Levy is prudent, and I think rightly so. And I think he's done a fantastic job in managing the finances. In fact, I would say, as a businessman, Daniel Levy gets 10 out of 10.
Probably, yeah.
I don't understand really what more he could have done for the club in terms of making it profitable, delivering a new training ground, stadium, academy. He's done an amazing, amazing job as a businessman. As a human being, probably a 1 out of 10. Like, as Nathan says, why is he shitting on fans still? There's no need. Like, we are client reference numbers who have money extracted from us for more and more things on an annual basis. And it's a pity. I don't think he really understands what it's like to be a normal person with costs as they are these days in the UK. And I think that's fairly typical of most millionaires. They just don't know what it's like to be you or I. And Daniel Levy's not unusual in that. He is what he is. But in terms of a football club owner, I'm definitely like very happy with the way that Levy runs the club on the whole. And I think if the trust can get back into a position where they can challenge on things like ticket prices over the next couple of years, then let's get a bit of balance between Levy the businessman and Levy the human being, and let's see what he can do for the fans to make the experience a bit easier.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he froze absolutely. Season ticket prices this year, but match day prices went up, single match tickets went up, which mm-hmm. just makes us all believe that next year the season tickets will go up to match those individual tickets. Freezing that would be quite nice.
Yeah, I want to touch on PRS for just a second. Did I get it wrong again?
Spending... it's profit and sustainability,
right?
So PSR.
PSR. Really glad to see that has teeth. Like, obviously, I'm biased as a Spurs fan because it favours us more than any other club, probably. But I think even outside of that, I would be very glad, just as a football fan, as a Premier League fan, to see some curving on the financial doping that is decimating our sport. One particular tweak of it that is interesting is that because profits and losses are recorded on a player-for-player basis, we're in a situation where, and Gallagher is referencing the question, clubs are incentivized to sell their academy products because they go down as pure profit because you don't count the transfer costs. There's no transfer in cost to count against the transfer out profit. That's got to change. That's not right to be in a situation where we're and obviously we might take advantage of that situation as it is now with Gallagher, for example. But I think as a general point, it's not right that you get Chelsea, for example, would get a lot more out of selling a first 11 player Conor Gallagher than they'd get out of selling, you know, Nkunku, who's a more talented player but isn't an academy product. You know, something's gone wrong there. I think the costs need to be, and the ins and outs need to be generalized across the board rather than done on a player-for-player basis. There are talks of other tweaks to keep it more, because at the moment it's on a three-year rolling and they're talking of doing a season-by-season percentage of turnover. But again, it's got to be generalized. All money in, all money out, rather than player-for-player.
I think the way of balancing that, to be honest, Nathan, is to have more stringent homegrown regulations. So at the moment, clubs can decide to have no homegrown players at all in their squads if they want to. They just have a smaller squad. I think let's force clubs to name some homegrown players in their squads, and maybe even in the matchday squad. And that way, you won't be encouraged to sell players. You are encouraged to keep academy players. And if you want to sell... So I think the best way for us to use our academy is to bring through lots of young players and sell lots of them. Partly for this reason, but also partly because it gives you some... It helps build the squad up temporarily or long term, great, and helps develop more good young English footballers. So it's good for the national team as well. And I think if you're incentivized to develop lots of young players, you can keep a small proportion, then I think that's fine. That it's just the balance has to be right.
You have been listening to The Extra Inch with me, Windy, my sidekick and best friend, Barney, and our tactics guy, Nathan. If you like this, there's plenty more at patreon.com/theextrainch. Production is by Nathan A. Clark. Our logo, artwork and website are designed by Creighton Miller. Our music is by David Lindmer. You can find him on Instagram at David Lindmer. Do check him out. He's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us at podcast@theextrainch.co.uk. Subscribe, leave us a rating and a review. And most importantly, be sure to tell all of your Spurs friends. Shout out to the ex-subs, we love every single last one of you. And of course, come on you Spurs.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.